lighthouses and loneliness. The words sit so nicely together, it's easy to forget the facts of it. The fact that mostly you had two others with you out on the light to keep you company or drive you mad. But that didn't always help. You missed your home and your family. And not even the loveliest of lighthouses really helped. Keeper's accommodation on the Kish Lighthouse was renowned for its luxury, and not just by those who'd known the old Kish lightship, so cramped and constantly rocking that it was famously prone to an odd accident. Keeper's false teeth were lost over the side at a startling rate. The new 1965 model Kish had it all, even the radio telephone to shorten the distance to loved ones on shore, and even, come Christmas, to organise a sing-song, trading verses not just with other lights down the coast, but with crews from ships that were quite literally passing in the night. All the same, even that space-age jollity had its limits, what you would have given to see your smiling family. But optimism is what works best on a 5-week stint, so even if the X's and O's were a poor substitute for the actual hugs and kisses of your family, well, at least you had your teeth. Because what could be more lonesome when the cold spray spatters the tower than a lighthouse keeper without any teeth? In this week's Lighthouse Stories, we're moving into the spare room, taking a place at table and doing our fair share of the washing up, spending some time with some lighthouse families, mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, who all grew up at one end or the other of the lighthouse beam. Sound recordist Chris Watson often brings his mics to the Farne Islands, nicknamed the Galapagos of the North, because that's the sort of thing people do, but also because of the abundance of wildlife there. The islands were also the former home of the lighthouse family of all lighthouse families, the Darlings, and their heroic daughter, Grace.
The Farne Islands is an archipelago which stretches just offshore from in between Bamburgh and Sea Houses in Northumberland, between sort of 5 and about 9 miles out. And this is a very inhospitable place for shipping, this collection of rocks which are tidal. The Farne Islands consists of 10 islands at high tide and 15 islands at low tide. Consequently, there has been a lighthouse on the Brownsman, one of the central islands of the Farne Islands, for centuries, and it's actually a place where I've stayed. It's no longer a lighthouse, but it was the lighthouse keeper's cottage. Even further out, the most extreme outpost of the Farnes is the Longstone. And so, round about the middle of the 19th century, the Longstone Light was built. This red and white hooped lighthouse just perched on the very edge of the Farnes, just right on the edge of the deep water of the North Sea. And a family lived out there, the Darlings. One of the members of the family was Grace Darling, a teenager. In the early hours of the 7th of September 1838, young Grace Darling looked out of her bedroom window on the second floor of the lighthouse to see a ship being wrecked out on some tidal rocks, the big Harkar rocks. And this was a paddle steamer, the Forfarshire, full of people navigating up the coast towards Scotland. Such was the rush, because people were already in the water. The Forfarshire had actually broken in half across the rocks of Great Harkar. There was no time to signal by rocket, no radio in those days, to get the onshore lifeboat from Sea Houses out to rescue these people. So William Darling, the lighthouse keeper, and his daughter Grace set out in this longboat and rowed out through these great waves. And William was in the water rescuing people, several men and one surviving woman, while Grace held the oars on this large wooden longboat and steadied the boat as these people were rescued, and they then rowed back to the Longstone Light. And then the rescue continued with relays of other people. But Grace's story just went nationwide, that this young woman had helped rescue 9 or so survivors from the 52 that were on the Forfarshire. And her fame grew with this great act of altruism, the very essence of what lighthouse keepers are there for, to protect shipping and, if necessary, to save lives. So Grace became this remarkable and reluctant national hero. William Wordsworth wrote a poem about her. She even appeared on the cover of boxes of Cadbury's chocolate at the time. Remarkable story about a woman who lived in such an isolated place and risked her life to save those of others that night in September 1838.
The search for the gene for lighthouse keeping hasn't yet been successful, but that can only be because we haven't examined the DNA of Gerald Butler, a third generation lighthouse keeper on both sides of his family. Gerald got an early flavour of lighthouse life and its challenges, big and small, on Ballycotton Lighthouse.
I would have been about maybe 6, maybe 7, around those years. And my father brought Edmund, my twin, he brought him out first to Ballycotton. And after a week, I was brought out. And I was enthralled and excited, and I didn't mind, strangely enough, being on my own on the rock. I was afraid in the dark as soon as we went into the bedroom. I was afraid. Ballycotton, the place was alive with ants. I had to sleep in the same bed as my father, so it was a single bed, a single steel-framed bed. And the legs of the bed were standing in four. Each of the legs were standing in a bean tin full of water. So that was the moat for to keep the ants at bay. Once I was asleep, he could get up and do his watch as he did. And that was grand. But he'd come to bed with me and get me settled into the bed. And sure, you know, having been around the rock with him all day, I was tired and I didn't put up any resistance, you know. We lived on Ballycotton. We were children on Ballycotton. We later lived at Minehead and latterly at Galleyhead. Now, when we were at Galleyhead, we were near finishing our education. One of the supernumeraries, Jim Whelan, now he's living in Ballycotton, was at the galley. We said to Jim, look, we want to get up in the morning at 6 o'clock. And Jim was on duty at 6 a.m. We had a piece of twine. We laid it along on the floor and up through the window and down the side of the house. And we had it hidden behind the downpipe where no one could see it. So we showed it to Jim and we said to him in the morning, you just pull that at 6 o'clock. And we had it tied onto our toe. So when I was asleep in bed in the morning, the next thing I knew is my leg was out of the bed and being hauled over towards the window, and Jim was pulling, he was having right sport, pulling me over to the window. Anyway, I signalled to Jim that I was up. I called Edmund and the two of us crept out of bed, got dressed, went down to the kitchen, got our breakfast. If it was winter time, we would go up into the lighthouse. We'd do his 6 to 10 watch for him and have the light extinguished before we went to school, and nobody knew about it. My father never knew about it, or the other lightkeeper never knew about it. But that's where we would do our homework in the morning, was up inside in the lighthouse between the two tiers of light, because you had the heat rising up from the lower light. And if it was fine, then we'd gallop away off out around the cliffs and get up to whatever we could, and then off to school into Clonakilty. So, yeah, we had that kind of crack.
For many lighthouse families, there was nothing to do but accept that the Fire and Tea might be at the wrong end of the beam, offshore for weeks and weeks on end. But after several such postings, Ray Wickham and his wife Eileen settled at a land station beneath the thick black hoops of Hookhead Lighthouse, as idyllic a posting as the service offered.
What I can remember most was in the summer months, going down there among the little pools and the mackerel jumping from the water to come in to catch the fry that was just stuck among the rocks, and just catching those mackerel in your hand, taking them straight up to the kitchen, frying it on the pan, calling the children who were down bathing and maybe having a little paddle in the rocks up. Simple, pleasant things like that to me, the changing of the seasons from that to going to the storms in winter, and when the sea would hit the back wall, it would come right over the house and it would just leave seaweed scattered on windows everywhere, and people would come down and say, oh gosh, how could you live here in the winter? But you just took it in your stride. That was it. And it was so unique that our children went to bed and went to sleep each night with the beam of the lighthouse.
It was paradise to me to come here from the offshore rocks to be with my family, and we had a child here. And it was got a little car, little feet, 500, and it was paradise. 3 years.
It's a way of life passed into the annals of history. And I suppose, as my tribute to lighthouse keepers, both passed on and maybe still around, but no longer in the service, all I can say is their likes won't be seen again.
But even at the most perfect lighthouses, the dangers of the sea and the possibilities of tragedy were never quite banished.
And the other thing we experienced was that the Aer Lingus Viscount plane went down off the Tusker. Raymond was on the Tusker at that particular time.
It was major because people continually asked, did you see it, or why didn't you see it? We felt very badly about that, but we met a man, the Royal Navy landed there sometime afterwards, and one man had gone through the Second World War in the Navy, and he said, you wouldn't have much chance, he said, when the plane hits the sea, it'll splash, it's gone. He saw a lot of aircraft being shot down during the war, so we had to take him at his word for that, you know. If you weren't looking exactly in the right place at the right time, you might hear something, but the crash, the splash subsides straight off, the plane's gone down.
Very difficult to see. The ponderous seas at the Tusker Lighthouse, the way they used to go in underneath the rock, where there was a...
Yeah, there was caves hole, there in the sea, boom, would be booming in the caves, yeah.
Similar, perhaps, to...
to a cannon shot, yeah, or a crash. But yeah, two of the men were outside, in fact, walking up and down at the time. And similarly, they must have their backs turned to the earth, crash when it happened. When they turned around and walked back in the southerly, in the easterly direction, there was nothing to be seen. So it was just bad luck, very bad luck.
My friend,
no survivors.
Actually the air hostess on board. She wasn't actually due to be on that flight. I think she just, somebody either had to go to a wedding or something, and she just stepped in, and unfortunately...
That girl's body amazingly washed up inside the Stenny River, almost to Wexford town. So that was a very strange thing.
And she was born and reared in Wexford.
That means it had to drift all the way into Wexford Harbour and up the river and all the way up. Yeah.
Seems a lifetime away.
We've called out lifeboat on numerous occasions, of course. Called lifeboat several times, and people were saved as a result of that. But we weren't directly involved in any sort of life-saving, just that the lifeboat launched and went out and did the business. And God knows how many lives you saved by just keeping the lights operating and the fog signals operating. You just don't know.
But the eyes,
but you see, but strangely, people think a lightkeeper's job is to watch out for trouble, but your job is to do the very exactly the opposite. Your job is to keep the maintain the navigational aids, especially in storms. Those times were very manually operated. Engines for fog signals, diesel engines, and the light was operated manually as well. It had to be attended. That was your job.
I think the only thing that we can recall, really, Raymond, was when you were at Mizzen Head and Charles Haughey's yacht.
That's right.
Came into
view.
Danger, came into view, dangerous waters there, and one of the lighthouse keepers, was it Tom?
I'm not sure, Jerry Butler, I think Jerry was there.
No, but the lad that actually rescued him, that went down, through the rope down, Richard Ford.
Richard Ford, yes,
Richard
that's right,
Ford.
Richard Ford,
yes,
that's right,
yeah,
yeah,
Richard
right,
Ford.
Yeah.
And quick thinking on Richards Park, it just threw the rope down and that was it.
Neil Clotworthy was Engineer-in-Chief of Irish Lights when he retired in 1982 after a lifetime of setting up and keeping lights burning, including contributing to the great Kish build of the 1960s. And it's the beam of the Kish that his daughter Suzanne Marr remembers him by now. But both Suzanne and Neil's grandson Christian also remember his work on a more domestic scale was pretty impressive too.
When he had a major project on his mind, like he designed the Castletown Bear Light, which brings thousands of fishermen and boats in safely, you know, past the island and into the harbour, he would be trying out different things at home. My sister reminded me the other day of how we had to tolerate the dining room in complete darkness for a week. I don't know whether it was to do with the Castletown Bear light, but certainly his experiments did affect
us. It could have been photoelectric, yeah. It would make sure these lights turn on and off at the right times, day and night.
Yes.
It could have been. And
it's funny how he got away with it with my mother and ourselves, but I think we all knew how much it meant to him, and we never insisted that he should clear away.
There was different inventions all of the time. He had one for scaring the birds off his vegetable patch, which was a pyramid made out of mirrors that the pigeons would see another pigeon flying towards them and attack the oncoming pigeon. And I think after a number of pigeons had died in the vegetable plot, my grandmother had put an end to that device. There was always something going on, yeah.
He had a garage which was just two steps down off from the kitchen. He made a smelting furnace up the garden for some of his inventions. He built a further shed and workshop up the garden, which he called Okanagan Lodge. Okanagan being one of his favourite places in Canada, from where he came indeed.
He fitted an intercom system into that workshop so that my grandmother could call him back down for dinner without having to leave the house. And the smelting works he used to make her a gold ring on one occasion, and he used the mould of a Bewley's Barnbrack ring to fashion it. So she had a perfect Bewley's Barnbrack ring in pure gold,
which she treasured to the end of her life.
In 1952, he joined the Irish Lights, and he was their first professional electrical engineer in that service. There was a great expansion at the time of navigation lights, the electrification of many of them, the introduction of radio beacons, Raycon, which is a radar transponder. It was a bit of a golden age, I suppose, at that time. There was an awful lot happening, a lot of electricity. So shortly after he started in 52, they started on the Innistrahull tower and light. They decided to upgrade everything that was there and build a new lighthouse. So this was the first lighthouse tower to be built since the beginning of the state, the Fastnet being the last tower that had been built. The lighthouse there had a fortnightly relief for the people on the light, and it was run by a local family running out of Malin Head, and they'd held a contract there for 100 years before that. So involvement in lighthouses.
Neil Clotworthy was part of a team that designed the Kish Lighthouse, in operation since November 1965. This ambitious project established a fixed light on a sandbank off Dublin Bay using a telescopic structure built in Dunleary Harbour and towed into place on that treacherous sandbank. Bill Long had Neil Clotworthy himself on hand to explain some of the novel methods, big and small, used in the Kish project.
Neil Clotworthy, an engineer with Irish Lights, recalls how some of those problems were overcome. He was equally creative in devising a method to measure the tide race on the Kish bank.
If you put a large object down on a sandy bed, the tide can scour away the sand and the whole structure could become unstable. So we wanted to know how strongly the tide flowed, not at the top, but down at the bottom. At depth. So we made inquiries as to how this might be measured, and we were told how to do it. Now, this is really high technology stuff. We were told what you need is a baby's bottle, some bird's jelly deluxe, bit of string, a cork, and a brick. So we registered some astonishment at this, but we were told how to go about it. First of all, you half fill the bottle with Bird's Jelly Deluxe. You drill a hole down through the centre of the cork, put the string through it, and bung up the bottle. You tie the other end of the string to the brick, so that when the thing is immersed in water, the baby's bottle will float upside down. You then go out in your boat with a bucket of hot water. You put the bottle into it so that the jelly once again melts. You tie a heaving line to the assembly, throw it over, it hits the bottom, and you wait there for about 10 minutes. You then pull up the bottle. Now, the bottle has been in a strong tide and is leaning over at a peculiar angle. But the jelly has solidified to that angle, and all you have to do is to measure the angle. There's a further refinement. If you want to know in what direction the tide is, you float a little compass needle in the jelly. So you have not only strength, but you have direction as well.
Now, that was a classic. We called him Pamps. That was a classic grandfather solution. He just loved that sort of simple solution. The lighthouse itself was essentially a telescopic. It was a tube, just a concrete tube, over fitted within another, and it was dragged out or floated out to position, sunk there, and then one column was filled with water, which pumped the lighthouse up to the correct level, and where it was made good, and the inner tube was filled with, or the lower tube was filled with sand. And yeah, it's still there today, obviously. I think they said the scope for his talent really came to light when it came to the fit out of that house then, which was, it was fitted out with radar transponders, radio beacons, the light itself, of course. And of course, you know, you don't think about all of these other things, but there's generators, there's telephone systems, there's radio telephone systems, there's all sorts to go into these things.
Well, part of the job for my father was he had to go to any lighthouse that he might be called to where there was a problem for a few days or even longer. My mother didn't like that, but he never faltered. He knew that was part of the brief.
You know, a serious failure of an electrical installation meant that it was a danger to shipping. So there was no choice but to drop everything.
Including
the tools to do the hatch.
Yes.
And head off and get these things fixed.
He would say, oh, this will only take a few hours. Don't worry, I'll be back. My mother always was worried, because she didn't like him being away, because if the weather got bad, then he would be marooned. But we were always at him to make a hatch between our kitchen and dining room to make it easier to pass the plates in and out. And this day he said, oh, right, I'll start. So he started to take it down brick by brick, making a lovely hole in the wall. And the phone went, and he was, Mr. Clotworthy, can you come? We've got an urgent problem. I think it might have been Tory Island. Off he went, and he said, see you in the next day or two. 8 weeks he was stranded on the lighthouse, actually nearly running out of supplies. And he experienced a lot of the island life in that time, rather enjoying it at first, you know, the solitude and the wonderful nature around him and everything, but he then began to want to come home. He finally got home, and he was in the door, and before we were back from school, he had grown a big, bushy beard, which none of us were allowed to see. My mother made him take it off immediately. So, but 8 weeks he was on Tory Island. But he had a night, they were very friendly with him. He went to a local Cayley and different social events, and he enjoyed it. And in the meantime, we were struggling with plates and crumbling dust and debris as we passed the plates in and out. We wanted to use the hatch, but it was a disaster until he came home. When I go down to the seafront I often go down at night, and I see the kish twinkling, and I just say, "Hello, Dad." For me, it's the epitome of him.
It's reliable, it's functional, and it's reassuring. And those are all character traits that we would certainly associate with him.
Mm.
While some families had sea views or prolonged absences to prove they were of lighthouse-keeping stock, sometimes even the whiff of a lighthouse from your name could be rewarding, as Dermot Bulger discovered.
My father was a sailor with the Wexford Steam Pack as a young man, and they only on these small coasters. They only went around. They went to Lisbon in the end, but initially they only went to small ports. And he was in Dunmore East, and he fell into company with an old fisherman who said to him, "What's your name?" And he said, "Roger Bulger." "And where are you from?" And he said, "Wexford Town." "Wexford Town. Do you know a Francis Bulger?" He said, "Francis Bulger's my father." "A bit of hokey, your man." He said, "Come here. You're keep your hand in your pocket. Your money is no good here." And he filled my father with drink, which, as my father was a young man of 19 or 20, was absolutely delighted and kept praising Francis Bulger, what a great man Francis Bulger was. And then said to my father, "And is he still at the lighthouse keeping?" My father said, no, he's actually a printer with the Free Press in Wexford." The man said, "What do you mean printing? He's a lighthouse keeper. He saved my life 30 years ago." "Mother of Jesus," your man said, "I've the wrong Bulger." And he'd been buying drinks for my father on the premise that he was a lighthouse keeper who had saved my father's life. But I'm sure he was related in some way to my father, so we're not giving the drinks back at this stage.
Dermot Bulger there, making his bid to join the Darlings, the Wickhams, the Clotworthies and the Butlers in this little island's great big lighthouse family.